swoon all over the globe, and he was waving as though there were thousands of us instead of a handful. Bill stood by the boombox Maxwell had set up, and when Bubba leaped onto the tiny stage and thanked us all very much, the lights went down. Bill started the music. Kentucky Rain. It was incredible. What can I say? Victor was totally entranced, or as totally as someone who's perpetually wary can be. Victor leaned forward, Mindy and Mark forgotten, the other vampires forgotten, to absorb the experience. After all, he had Akiro to watch out for him, and Akiro was on the job, no doubt about it. His eyes never fixed on Bubba, but swept the room. Luis and Antonio had positioned themselves by the front door, guarding Akiro's back, and the bodyguard's eyes were doing a 180-degree scan of the rest of the club as he stood behind Victor. As Bubba bowed to the applause, which was as thunderous as our small crowd could manage, Bill started the music again. This time we heard In the Ghetto. Red tears ran down Victor's face. I glanced over my shoulder to see that Luis and Antonio were rapt. The two nameless vampires were standing close to Bill, their hands folded in front of them, watching the show. Anna Lyudmila was not a music lover, apparently. She was looking bored as she sat on the end of a bench at one of the booths close to the front door. I could see her over Mark's shoulder. Thalia, who was about half Anna Lyudmila's size, sidled up to her and silently offered a tray laden with more drinks. Anna Lyudmila nodded graciously, selected one, and took a big swallow. After a second in which her expression flashed absolute horror, she crumpled. Thalia caught the bottle as it fell from Anna Lyudmila's fingers. The lethal and ancient vampire silently shoved the limp body farther into the booth and turned to look at the stage, standing so as to block the sprawl of Anna Lyudmila's legs. The whole episode took less than 30 seconds. I had no idea what had been in the drink. Some form of liquid silver? Was that possible? That little subplan had been contingent on one of the vamps being out of the line of sight of the others, and fortunately for us, it had paid off. One down. We wanted to take out as many as possible before the fighting even started. Palomino, whose whitish hair and lovely golden skin made her a standout, worked her way close to Antonio by casual increments. She caught Antonio's eye, and she smiled, but she was careful not to overdo it. My purse was on the floor in the tiny space between my chair and Eric's. I dipped my hand down into its open mouth and withdrew a very sharp stake. I pressed it into Eric's waiting hand. After a second of leaning on his shoulder to cover the move, I eased upright to give him room. Maxwell Lee, who'd been standing by the door back to the offices, took off his suit coat and folded it carefully. I appreciated his clothes care, but it was like a signal he was about to take action. He seemed to realize it, because he settled on the edge of a booth after that. While Bubba stuck to ballad-type songs, he was entrancing, but for his next number, he'd picked Jailhouse Rock, and somehow a tinge of sadness seemed to wash over the performance. Though the transition to vampirism had eased all of his infirmities, he'd still died in poor physical condition, and he still bore the marks of age. Now that he was singing a dancing number, the effect was slightly pathetic. I saw the little audience begin to lose their engrossment in the performance. Switching the tone was a mistake, but one we couldn't have foreseen. I felt Eric's arm tense beside me, and then, with the speed of a striking snake, he leaned forward to clear Mindy Simpson to his left. His right arm rose up, and he swung in to stake Victor in the chest. As a sneak attack, it was perfect. Eric would have hit the mark exactly if Akiro, with equally terrifying speed, hadn't whipped out his sword and brought it down as Eric moved. Mindy Simpson was doomed to be in the wrong place at the wrong second. Akiro's sword struck her shoulder during its passage to Eric's arm and simply hewed through it, her bones and flesh slowing the lethal blade almost long enough for Eric to escape. All hell broke loose. Mindy screamed and died within seconds, and the amount of blood was simply incredible. While she died, A lot of things happened almost simultaneously. As Mark was still gaping, Victor was trying to shove aside Mindy's slumping and bleeding body, Akira was trying to disentangle his sword, and Eric was ducking and moving forward to evade another slice of the sword. Eric's arm was bleeding, but thanks to Mindy's unintentional block, it was still operative. I stood and lunged backward to get out of the way, knocking my chair aside, and rammed right into Luis, who was launching himself forward to protect his master. I spoiled Luis's trajectory, and we ended up in a heap on the floor. Fortunately for me, he was too intent on the vampire part of the fight to consider me at all dangerous, and he simply used me as a springboard to push off. Not that that felt exactly good, but it wasn't fatal. I scrambled up to a crouch and tried to figure out what to do next. In the dimmed lights, it wasn't easy to decide what was happening. A fighting pair close to the club doors proved to be Palomino and Antonio, and a small figure flying through the air must have been Thalia. She meant to land on Akiro's back, but he turned at the last second so incredibly fast, and instead she hit his chest and he staggered. His sword was not a weapon for close fighting, not with Thalia doing her best to rip his throat out with her teeth. Mark Simpson was staggering away from the body of his wife and the fighting vampires, and he was saying, oh my God, over and over. But he did manage to take cover behind the bar, where he grabbed a bottle and began trying to find someone to hit. I felt I could handle Mark Simpson, and I pushed to my feet. Colton took care of it before I could get there. He grabbed his own bottle and swung it at the back of Mark Simpson's head, and Mark staggered and went down. While Thalia was keeping Akira occupied, Eric and Pam went for Victor. There's no such thing as a fair bar brawl. They double-teamed him. Maxwell Lee very precisely staked Antonio from the back while he was struggling with Palomino. I could hear Bubba yelling in an agitated way. I got myself over to the stage and took Bubba's arm. Hey, it's okay, I said. So many people were yelling and screaming that I wasn't sure he'd hear me, but after I repeated myself about 20 more times, he stopped the screaming, thank you God, and said,
Miss Suki, I want to get out of here.
Sure, I said, trying to keep my own voice calm and level when I wanted to scream too. You see that door over there? I pointed to the door that led to the back of the rest of the club, Eric's office, and so on. You go back there and wait. You did great, just great. Bill will be back there directly, I'm sure.
Okay,
he said forlornly, and I saw his silhouette moving against the faint light coming from the open door. I finally located Bill, who was picking his way through the combatants with his eyes on the prize. He took Bubba by the arm to steer him to safety, which was Bill's designated job. I was proud to see that Bill had left one of the nameless vampires dead on the floor, already flaking away. I was so intent on Bubba that I didn't see Audrina staggering toward me, her hands on her throat and blood pouring from a wound, until she actually collided with me, causing me to go down on my knees. I don't know what her goal was. Maybe she was trying to go past me to the bar to get a towel to staunch the red flow. Maybe she was just trying to get away from her attacker, but she never made it. She went down full length on the floor a yard past me, and there was nothing I could do for her. I sensed movement behind me as I touched her wrist, and I threw myself away from the body just in time to dodge a blow from the bartender, Jock. He had excellent survival instincts, going after human women instead of vampires. Indira, her sari billowing around her, gripped Jock's heavy arm and swung him with enough force that he cannoned into a wall. A hole appeared in the wall, and Jock reeled back, unsteady on his feet. Indira threw herself down to the floor, reached between his legs, and gripped. Screaming, Jock stomped and kicked, but Indira emasculated him. I had a new, most horrible thing I've ever seen. Blood poured from Jock, thick and dark, and he looked down in shock while Indira shrieked in victory. With sudden determination, he swung his clenched fists and smacked her in the side of the head. Indira went flying, and it was her turn to collide with the wall. She lay still on the floor for a second, shaking her head as if there were flies buzzing around it. Jock went for her, but I caught hold of his shoulder long enough to slow him down a bit, and at the moment he reached her, Indira revived enough to launch herself upward, throwing a fold of her sari across his face long enough to blind him while she caught the stake I tossed to her and drove it into his heart. Jock, I hardly knew ye. I tried to do a quick evaluation. Jock down, Mark and Mindy Simpson down, Anna Ludmilla down, Antonio down, unknown enemy vamp number one down. Luis, where'd he gone? I heard a shot outside and figured that answered my question. Sure enough, Luis ran back into the club with a wound in his left shoulder. Mustafa Khan was waiting with a very long knife. Luis put up a furious fight despite the bullet wound, and he had a concealed weapon too. He drew out his own blade and scored a cut on Mustafa, but Emmanuel kicked Luis's knee from the back, and Luis crumpled. Rubio took advantage of the moment of weakness to drive in a stake. Though Mustafa said, "Oh, hell," with great disgust, he bowed to Rubio. Surprised, Rubio bowed back. Palomino was having trouble with unknown enemy vamp number two, who fought like a fiend. Maybe Palomino was not as skilled a fighter or as old, but she was bloody and weakening. Parker, who was evidently not much of a brawler, kept Tattoo's back and repeatedly jabbed him with an ice pick, which was not too effective, but obviously irritating. Two, a hefty vamp who'd been turned in his 30s, would heal up only to be punctured again. I'm sure it hurt like hell. Parker was apparently too scared to get in close enough to pierce Two's heart. Palomino was too slow from her many wounds to immobilize him. Mustafa, thwarted from the Luis kill, shoved Parker aside and beheaded Two with a dramatic sweep of his blade. Now, Akiro and Victor were the only enemies left standing. They both knew they were fighting for their lives. Pam's mouth was bloody, but I couldn't tell if the blood was her own or Victor's. I felt the Cluviel door press into my waist as I thought of pulling it out, but the next instant, Akiro managed to cut Thalia's arm off. Thalia grabbed it as it fell and hit Akiro with it, and Heidi jumped in behind him and stabbed him through the neck. Akiro dropped his sword to pluck at his throat, and I nipped in to seize the weapon so he couldn't retrieve it. The sword was long and not as heavy as I had anticipated. I stepped back to get it farther away from his groping hands, and just then, Victor knocked Eric to the wall and pushed Pam down on her back, throwing himself on top of her right in front of me. He bit her neck, his hands locking her shoulders down. She looked up at me, her face eerily calm. "Do it," she said. "No, I might cut Pam."
"Do it."
She was absolutely compelling. Her own hands flew up to grip Victor by his upper arms, locking him down. Eric was staggering to his feet, blood dripping from his head, his wounded arm, and his side. He'd bitten Victor at least once, going by his reddened mouth. I looked down at Pam, who was holding on to our enemy with everything she had. She nodded, turned her head to the side. She closed her eyes. I wished I could do the same. I took a breath and swung the sword down. Chapter 16. Pam shoved Victor off and leaped to her feet. I'd been so scared I'd kill Pam that I hadn't been forceful enough. I hadn't cut all the way through Victor, though I'd severed his spinal column. The sword stuck on the bone and I couldn't remove it. Horrified at myself, at the sensation of cutting into Victor, I backpedaled and covered my mouth. Pam yanked the sword out of the wound and decapitated Victor.
"Surrender,"
Eric said to the gravely wounded Akiro. Akiro shook his head. The wound in his throat prevented him from speaking.
"All right, then,"
Eric said wearily. He grabbed Akiro's head and broke his neck. The audible snap was deeply disgusting. I turned away, my stomach heaving while I told it to sit down and shut up. While Akiro lay helpless, Eric staked him. And it was over. Victor and all his vampire attendants, and his human attendants too, were dead. there were enough flaking vampires to change the quality of the air. I sank down on a chair. Actually, I lost control of my legs and a chair happened to be underneath me. Thalia was weeping over the pain of her amputated arm, but she was struggling hard against this display of weakness. Indira squatted on the floor looking exhausted but gleeful. Maxwell Lee, Parker, and Rubio had lesser injuries. Pam and Eric were covered in blood, both their own and Victor's. Palomino walked slowly over to Rubio and put her arms around him, drawing Parker into the embrace. Colton was kneeling by the dead Audrina, weeping. I never wanted to see another battle, large or small, in my life. I looked at my lover, my husband, and he looked like a stranger to me. He and Pam stood facing each other, holding hands and beaming through the blood. Then they simply collapsed into each other, and Pam began laughing in a breathless way.
"It's done," she said. "It's done. We're free."
"Until Felipe de Castro comes down on us like a ton of bricks because he wants to know what happened to his regent," I thought. But I didn't say anything. A, I wasn't sure I could. B, we'd already wondered what would happen, but Eric's opinion was that it was better to ask forgiveness than permission. Mustafa was on his cell phone, which was about as big as a cricket.
"Warren, no point in you coming in, man," he said. "The deed is done. Good shot. Yeah, we got him."
Parker said,
"Sheriff, we're leaving for home, unless you need us."
The weedy young man was supporting Palomino, and Rubio was on her other side. They were all pretty battered in one way or another.
"You may go."
Eric, smeared with blood, was still very much the ruler.
"You answered my call and did your jobs. You'll be rewarded."
Palomino, Rubio, and Parker mutually assisted each other to the back door. From their expressions, I was sure they hoped Eric didn't call them in again for a long, long time, no matter what the reward might be. Indira crawled over to Thalia to apply Thalia's severed arm to its shoulder with force. She held it there. Beaming Indira was the happiest person in the club.
"Will that work?"
I asked Pam, nodding at the shoulder-arm conjunction. Pam was wiping the bloody sword on Akiro's clothing. His throat was almost gone. Wounded parts disintegrate more quickly than uninjured parts.
"Sometimes," she said, shrugging. "Since Thalia is so old, there's a chance. It's less painful and time-consuming than regeneration."
"Thalia, can I get you some blood?"
I didn't think I'd ever been brave enough to address Thalia directly, but I could sure bring her some bottled blood and be glad to do it. She looked up at me, her eyes full of involuntary tears. It was obvious she was forcing herself to hold still.
"Not unless you want to donate yourself,"
she said in her heavily accented English.
"But Eric wouldn't be pleased if I drank from you. Emmanuel, give me a mouthful."
"All right," he said. The skinny hairdresser looked more than a little dazed.
"You sure?"
I asked.
"You don't quite seem yourself."
"Hell yes,"
Emmanuel said unconvincingly.
"The guy who killed my sister is dead. I'm feeling good."
He didn't look it, but I was sure I didn't either. I'd said as much as I could, so I sat by while Emmanuel crouched awkwardly before Thalia's chair. The height differential was not in their favor. Thalia wrapped her good arm around Emmanuel's neck and sank her fangs in without any further discussion. The expression on Emmanuel's face went from bleak to blissful. Thalia was a noisy eater. Indira squatted beside her in her blood-drenched sari, patiently holding the severed limb to its source. As Thalia drank, I noticed that the arm looked more and more natural. The fingers flexed. I was astonished, but it was only one more extreme event during an evening of them. Pam looked a little put out once her victory celebration with Eric was over and she saw that Emmanuel was offering his blood to someone else. She asked Mustafa if he'd give her a drink, and he shrugged.
comes with a job, he said, pulling down the neck of his black t-shirt. Pam looked incredibly white against Mustafa, and Mustafa's teeth bared in a grimace when she bit in. He, too, looked happier after a second. Eric came over to me, beaming. I had never been more undiluted glad that our bond was broken, because I didn't want to feel what he was feeling, even a little bit. He put his arms around me, kissed me with enthusiasm, and all I could smell was blood. He was wet with it. It was getting all over my dress and my arms and my chest. After a minute, he drew back, frowning.
Sookie, he said, you're not rejoicing?
I tried to think of what to say. I felt like a big fat hypocrite. Eric, I'm glad we don't have to worry about Victor anymore. And I know this was what we planned. But surrounded by dead people and body parts is not my idea of a good place for a celebration, and I've never been less horny in my life. His eyes narrowed. He didn't like my raining on his parade. Understandable. And that was the thing, wasn't it? I found all of this understandable. But I still hated it, hated myself, wasn't too fond of anyone else. You need some blood, I said. I really am sorry you were wounded, and you go ahead and take some.
You are being a hypocrite, and I will take blood, he said, and he struck.
It hurt. He didn't make it feel good, an action almost automatic for a vampire. Tears ran down my face without my wanting them to. In an odd way, I felt the pain was merited, justified. But I also understood this was a turning point in our relationship. Our relationship had been marked by 1,000 turning points, seemed like. Then Bill stood at my shoulder, staring at Eric's mouth on my throat. His expression was complex, rage, resentment, longing. I was ready for something simple, and I was ready for the pain to stop. My eyes met Bill's.
Sheriff,
Bill said. His voice had never been smoother. Eric twitched, and I knew he'd heard Bill, knew Eric realized he should stop, but he didn't. I shook myself free of the lethargy and self-loathing, grabbed hold of Eric's earlobe, and pinched as hard as I could. He detached with a gasp. His mouth was bloody. Bill's gonna take me home, I said. We'll talk tomorrow night. Maybe. Eric bent down to kiss me, but I flinched, not with that bloody mouth.
Tomorrow,
Eric said, his eyes searching my face. He turned away and called,
Listen up, people. We have to start cleaning the club.
They groaned like kids told to pick up their toys. Emmanuel went to Colton and helped him up.
You can stay at my place, Emmanuel said. It's not too far.
I won't sleep,
Colton answered.
Audrina's dead.
We'll get through the night, Emmanuel told him.
The two human men left Fantasia, their shoulders slumped with exhaustion and grief. I wondered how they felt about their vengeance now that it had been accomplished, but I knew I'd never ask them. I might never see them again. Bill put his arm around me as I stumbled a little, and I found myself glad he was there to help me. I knew I couldn't have driven myself. I found my purse, still with a couple of stakes inside, and I pulled my keys out of an inside pocket.
Where did Bubba go?
I asked.
He likes to go hang around the old civic auditorium, Bill said. He used to perform there. He'll dig a hole, sleep in the ground.
I nodded. I was too tired to say anything. Bill didn't speak again the whole way home, which was a blessing. I stared through the windshield into the black night, wondering how I'd feel tomorrow. That had been a lot of killing, and it had been so fast and bloody, like watching one of those violence porn movies. I'd seen a few seconds of one of the Saw movies when I was at Jason's house. That had been enough for me.
I fully believed that Victor had set this in motion with his own intransigence. If Felipe had put someone else in charge of Louisiana, the whole catastrophe wouldn't have occurred. Maybe I could blame Felipe. No, the buck had to stop here.
What are you thinking of?
Bill said as we were going down my driveway. I'm thinking about blame and guilt and assassination, I said. He simply nodded.
Me too. Sookie, you know that Victor did his best to provoke Eric.
We'd parked behind the house, and I turned to him questioningly, my hand on the car door handle.
Yes, Bill said. He was doing his best to provoke Eric to act so that he could kill Eric without having to justify it. It's only because of superior planning that Eric has survived and Victor has not. I know that you love Eric.
His voice remained calm and cool as he said this, and only the lines around his eyes told me how much it cost him.
You have to be glad. And maybe tomorrow you will be glad that this situation has ended the way it has.
I pinched my mouth together for a second while I formed my response. I'd rather Eric be alive than Victor, I said. True enough.
And you know violence was the only way to achieve that result.
I could even see that. I nodded.
So why the second guessing?
Bill said. He was calling me on my reaction. I let go of the door handle and turned to face him. It was bloody and ghastly, and people suffered, I said, surprised by the anger in my voice.
Did you think Victor would die without bleeding? Did you think Victor's people wouldn't do their best to prevent his death? Did you think that no one would die?
His voice was so calm and non-judgmental that I didn't get angry. Bill, I never believed any of those things. I'm not naive. But seeing is always different from planning. Abruptly, I was tired of this topic. It had happened. It was done. I had to find a way to get over it. Have you met the Queen of Oklahoma? I asked him.
Yes,
he said, a definite note of caution in his voice.
Why do you ask?
Before he died, Appius sort of gave Eric to her. This did shock Bill.
You're sure?
Yes. He finally told me after Pam did everything but stick her hand up his ass and wiggle her fingers to make him talk. Bill turned away, but not before I saw the smile he was trying to suppress.
Pam's very determined when she wants Eric to take a particular course of action. Did Eric tell you what he intends to do about this situation?
He's trying to get out of it, but evidently Appius signed something. When Appius told me before he died that I'd never keep Eric, I didn't know that was what he meant. I thought he meant Eric wouldn't want to fool with me when I got old and wrinkled, or that we'd quarrel and break up, or that, oh, I don't know. Something would happen to separate us.
And now something has.
Well, yes.
You know that he'll have to put you aside if he marries the queen. Eric can certainly feed off humans if he's married to a royal, and he can even have a pet human. But he can't have a wife.
That's what he gave me to understand.
Sookie, don't do anything rash.
I already broke the bond. After a long pause, Bill said,
That's a good thing because the bond was risky for both of you.
Not exactly news. I sort of miss having the connection, I confessed. But at the same time, it's a relief. Bill didn't say anything, very carefully. Have you ever? I asked.
Once long ago,
he said. He didn't want to talk about it. Did it end well?
No,
he said. His voice was flat and didn't invite me to continue that line of conversation.
Let it go, Sookie. I'm telling you this not as a former lover, but as a friend.
Let Eric make up his own mind about this. Don't ask him questions. Though we can't stand each other. I know Eric will try his best to get out of this situation simply because he loves his freedom. Oklahoma is very beautiful, and Eric loves beauty, but he already has that in you.
I must be feeling better if I could appreciate a compliment. I wondered what the queen's real name was. Often the ruler was called by the name of the land she ruled. Bill hadn't meant that the state was beautiful, but that the woman who ruled its night creatures was. When I didn't respond, Bill continued.
She also has a lot of power. That is, she has territory, minions, real estate, oil money.
And we both knew Eric loved power. Not complete power. He'd never wanted to be a king, but he loved being able to call the shots in his own bailiwick.
I get what power is, I said. And I get that I don't have it.
You want to take the car to your house or leave it here and go through the woods? He handed the keys to me and said,
I'll go through the woods.
There was nothing more to be said. Thanks, I told him. I opened the porch door, stepped in, locked it behind me. I unlocked the back door and went in, switching on the kitchen light. There was a quiet emptiness to the house, which I found immediately soothing, and the air conditioners were doing their best to make everything cool. Though I had come out of the fight at Fangtasia better than anyone, at least physically, I felt battered and bruised. I'd be sore the next day. I unbuckled the big belt and returned the Cluvial door to my makeup drawer. I pulled off the stained dress, went to the back porch to toss it in the washing machine on cold soak, and got in the shower, turning the water as hot as I could bear it. When I'd scrubbed myself all over, I changed the temperature to cool. I was delightfully clean and fresh when I got out to dry myself. I wondered if I would start crying or praying or sitting in a corner with my eyes wide open the rest of the night. But none of those reactions set in. I got into bed feeling relieved, as if I'd had a successful surgery or as if a biopsy had turned out well. I thought, as I curled into a ball and composed myself for sleep, that the fact that I could sleep tonight was almost more frightening than anything else. Chapter 17. All the women in my living room were happy. Some of them were happier than others, true, but none of them were miserable. They were there to give gifts to someone who deserved them, and they were happy that Tara was expecting twins. All the yellow and green and blue and pink tissue paper mounded up in an almost overwhelming way, but Tara was getting a lot of things she needed and wanted. Dermot was unobtrusively helping with the refreshments and bagging up the torn gift paper to keep the floor clear. Some of my older guests were definitely in the tottering stage, so we didn't need anything on the floor that might cause them to slip. JB's mom and grandmother were here, and his grandmother was 75 if she was a day. When Dermot had come to the back door earlier, I'd let him in and gone back to my coffee without a word. As soon as he was in the door, I felt measurably better. Maybe I hadn't noticed the contrast these past few weeks because I'd been so wrapped up in the blood bond. I'd been under the influence of a lot of supernatural things. I couldn't say it felt better to be just myself, but it certainly made me feel more in touch with reality. Once my guests had gotten a good look at Dermot and realized how much he looked like Jason, there'd been a lot of raised eyebrows. I told them he was a distant cousin from Florida, and I'd heard from a lot of brains that ladies were going to be consulting their family trees to find a Florida connection for my family. I felt like myself today. I felt like I was doing what I was supposed to be doing in the community where I lived. I might not even be that same person who'd participated in a slaughter the night before. I took a sip from my glass cup. Maxine's punch had turned out well. The cake I'd picked up from the bakery was delicious,
My cheese straws were crispy and just a little spicy, and the salted pecans were toasted just enough. We played baby bingo as Tara opened her gifts, and she glowed and said, "Thank you," about a million times. I felt more and more like the old Sookie Stackhouse as the event progressed. I was around people I understood, doing a good thing. As a kind of bonus, JB's grandmother told me a lovely story about my grandmother. Taken all together, it was a good afternoon. When I went in the kitchen with a tray full of dirty dishes, I thought, this is happiness. Last night wasn't the real me. But it had been. I knew, even as I thought this, that I wasn't going to be able to fool myself. I'd changed in order to survive, and I was paying the price of survival. I had to be willing to change myself forever, or everything I'd made myself do was for nothing.
Are you all right, Sookie?
Dermot asked as he brought in more glasses. Yes, thanks. I tried to smile at him, but felt it was a weak effort. There was a knock at the back door. I supposed it was a late guest, trying to sneak in unobtrusively. Mr. Cataliades stood there. He was wearing a suit, as always, but for the first time it seemed somewhat the worse for wear. He seemed not quite as circular as he had been, but he was smiling politely. I was astonished at his presence and not completely sure I wanted to talk to him, but if he was the guy who could answer big questions about my life, I really didn't have a lot of choice. "Come in," I told him, standing back and holding open the door.
"Miss Stackhouse,"
he said formally.
"Thank you for your welcome."
He stared at Dermot, who was washing dishes very carefully, proud to be trusted with Gran's good china.
"Young man," he said in acknowledgement.
Dermot turned and froze.
"Demon,"
he said. Then he turned back to the sink, but I could tell he was thinking furiously.
"You're having a social occasion?"
Mr. Cataliades asked me.
"I can tell there are many women in the house."
I hadn't even noticed the cacophony of feminine voices floating down the hall, but it sounded like there might be 60 women in the living room instead of 25. "Yes," I agreed, "there are. It's a baby shower for a friend of mine."
"Perhaps I could sit at your kitchen table until it's over," he suggested. "Perhaps a bite to eat?"
Reminded of my manners, I said, "Of course, you can have as much as you like." I quickly made a ham sandwich and put some chips and pickles out and prepared a separate plate with party goodies. I even poured him a cup of punch. Mr. Cataliades' dark eyes glowed at the sight of the food in front of him. It might not be as fancy as he was used to, though for all I knew he ate raw mice, but he dug in with a will. Dermot seemed all right, if not exactly relaxed, at being in the same room with the lawyer, so I left them to make the best of it and returned to the living room. The hostess couldn't be away for long. It wasn't polite. Tara had opened all the presents. Her shop assistant, McKenna, had written down all the gifts and the givers and taped the card in with each offering. Everyone was talking about her own labor and delivery. Oh, joy. And Tara was fielding questions about her OBGYN, the hospital where she'd deliver, what names they thought of for the babies, whether they knew the sexes of the twins, how far away her due date was, and on and on. Gradually, the guests began to depart, and when they were all gone, I had to fend off sincere offers from Tara and her mother-in-law and Jason's girlfriend, Michelle, to help with dishes. I told them, "No, sirree, you just leave them there, that's my job." And I could hear my grandmother's words flowing right out of my mouth. It almost made me laugh. If I hadn't had a demon and a fairy in my kitchen, I might have. We got all the gifts loaded into Tara's and her mother-in-law's cars, and Michelle told me she and Jason were having a catfish fry the next weekend, and they wanted me to come. I said I'd see. That sounded wonderful. It was a huge relief when all the humans were gone. I would have thrown myself in the chair and read for 30 minutes or watched an episode of Jeopardy before starting to clean up if I hadn't had the two men waiting in my kitchen. Instead, I had to march back laden with still more plates and cups. To my surprise, Dermot was gone. I hadn't noticed his car go down the driveway, but I assumed he'd blended in with all the other departing guests.
Mr. Catalyades was sitting in the same chair, drinking a cup of coffee. He had put his plate over by the sink. Hadn't washed it, but he carried it over.
So, I said, they've left. You didn't eat Dermot, did you?
He beamed at me.
No, dear Miss Stackhouse, I did not, though I'm sure he would be tasty. The ham sandwich was delicious.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, I responded automatically. Listen, Mr. Catalyades, I found a letter from my grandmother. I'm not sure I understand our relationship correctly, or maybe I just don't understand what it means that you are my sponsor. His beam intensified.
Though I'm in a slight hurry, I'll do everything I can to dispel your confusion.
Okay. I wondered why he was in a hurry, if he was still being pursued, but I wasn't going to be sidetracked. Let me sort of repeat this back to you, and you can tell me if I got it straight.
He nodded his round head.
You were good friends with my birth grandfather, Fintan, Dermot's brother.
Yes, Dermot's twin.
But you don't seem that fond of Dermot. He shrugged.
I'm not.
I almost got off on a tangent there, but I stuck to my train of thought. So, Fintan was still alive when Jason and I were born.
Desmond Catalyades nodded enthusiastically.
Yes, he was.
My gran said in her letter that you visited my dad and his sister, Fintan's actual children.
I was here.
So, did you give them, us, a gift?
I tried, but you couldn't all accept it. Not all of you had the essential spark.
That was a phrase Niall had used. What is the essential spark?
What a clever question,
Mr. Catalyades said, regarding me as if I were a monkey who'd opened a hatch to retrieve a banana.
The gift I gave to my dear friend Fintan was that any of his human descendants who possessed the essential spark would be able to read the minds of their fellow humans, as I can.
So, when it turned out that my dad and Aunt Linda didn't have it, you returned when Jason and I were born. He nodded.
Seeing you wasn't absolutely necessary. After all, the gift had been given. But by visiting Jason and then you, I could know for certain. I was very excited when I held you, though I think your poor grandmother was frightened.
So only I and...
I choked back Hunter's name. Mr. Catalyades had written Hadley's will, and she hadn't mentioned Hunter. It was possible he didn't know Hadley had had a child.
Only I have had it so far, and you still haven't explained what the spark is.
He gave me an arch look, as if to say he sure couldn't get anything by me.
The essential spark isn't easy to pin down in terms of your DNA,
he told me.
It's an openness to the other world. Some humans literally can't believe there are creatures in another world besides ours. Creatures who have feelings and rights and beliefs and deserve to live their own lives. Humans who are born with the essential spark are born to experience or perform something wonderful, something amazing.
I'd done something pretty amazing the night before. But it surely wasn't wonderful, unless you hated vampires. Gran had the essential spark, I said suddenly. So Fintan thought he'd find it in one of us.
Yes, though of course he never wanted me to give her my gift.
Mr. Catalyades looked wistfully at the refrigerator, and I got up to make him another ham sandwich. This time I sliced some fresh tomato and put it on a little plate, and he piled every single bit on the sandwich and still managed to eat it neatly. Now that was supernatural. When he'd finished half the sandwich, Mr. Catalyades paused to say,
Fintan loved humans, and he especially loved human women, and he even more greatly loved human women with the essential spark. They aren't so easy to find. He adored Adele so much that he put the portal in the woods so he could visit her more easily, and I'm afraid he was mischievous enough to...
And it was Mr. Cataliades' turn to stop and look at me uneasily, weighing his words.
He took my grandfather for a test drive every now and then, I said. Dermot recognized Fenton in some of the family pictures.
I'm afraid that was very naughty of him.
Yes, I said heavily. It was very naughty.
He had great hopes when your father was born, and I was here the day after to inspect him. But he was quite normal, though of course attractive and magnetic as half-fays are. Linda, the second child, was too. And I'm sorry about the cancer. That shouldn't have happened. I blame it on the environment. She should have been perfectly healthy all her life. Your father would have been, if the terrible infighting hadn't broke out among the fairies. Perhaps if Fenton had survived, Linda's health would have stayed with her.
Mr. Cataliades shrugged.
Adele tried to reach Fenton to ask if there was anything he could do for Linda, but by then he had passed away.
I wonder why she didn't use the Cluvial door to cure Aunt Linda's cancer.
I don't know,
he said with apparent regret.
Knowing Adele, I imagine she didn't think it would be Christian. It's possible that she didn't even remember she had it by that time, or that she regarded it as a romantic love token but nothing more. After all, by the time her daughter's illness became evident, it had been many years since I'd given it to her on Fenton's behalf.
I thought hard, trying to pare down this conversation to learn what I had to know.
Why on earth did you think telepathy would be such a great gift? I blurted.
For the first time, he looked a bit miffed.
I thought it would give Fenton's descendants an edge over their fellow humans for all of their lives, to know what other people were thinking and planning, he said. And since I'm nearly all demon, and I had it to give, it seemed a splendid gift to me. It would be wonderful even for a fairy. If your great-grandfather had known that Brendan's henchmen were determined to murder him, he could have squelched the rebellion before it caught hold. Your father could have saved himself and your mother from drowning if he'd known a trap was set for him.
But those things didn't happen.
Full-blooded fairies aren't telepathic, though they can sometimes send messages. They can't hear an answer. And your father didn't have the essential spark.
This seemed like a circular kind of conversation. So, what this all boils down to is this. Since you two were such good buddies, Fenton asked you to give his and Adele's descendants a gift to stand as their, our sponsor. Mr. Cataliades smiled.
Correct.
You were willing to do this, and you thought telepathy would be a dandy present.
Correct again. Though it seems I was mistaken.
You were. And you gave this gift in some mysterious demon way?
Not so mysterious, he said indignantly. Adele and Fenton each drank a thimbleful of my blood.
Okay, I could not picture my grandmother doing that. But then, I couldn't have imagined her consorting with a fairy either. In point of fact, it had become obvious that I'd known my grandmother very well in some respects, and not at all in others.
I put it in wine and told her it was a special vintage, Mr. Cataliades confessed. And in a way, it was so.
Okay, you lied. No big surprise there, I said, though Gran had been plenty smart, and I was sure she'd at least had suspicions. I waved my hands in the air. I could think about that later.
Okie dokie. So, after they'd both ingested your blood, any descendants of theirs would be telepathic if they were also born with this essential spark.
Correct.
He smiled so broadly that I felt I'd gotten an A on my test.
And my grandmother never used the Cluvial door.
No, it's a one-use thing. A very pretty gift from Fenton to Adele.
Can I use it to take away the telepathy?
No, my dear. It would be like wishing away your spleen or your kidneys. But an interesting thought.
So I couldn't help Hunter with it. Or myself, either. Damn. Can I kill someone with it?
Yes, of course, if that someone is threatening someone you love directly. You couldn't cause the death of your tax assessor unless he was standing over your brother with an axe, say.
Was it a coincidence that Hadley wound up with the Queen?
Not really, because she is part fairy, and, as you know, part fairy is very attractive to vampires. It was only a matter of time before a vampire came into the bar and saw you.
He was sent by the Queen.
Do tell.
Catalyades didn't look a bit surprised.
The Queen never asked me about the gift, and I never told her I was your sponsor. She never paid much attention to the world of the Fae, unless she wanted to drink fairy blood. She certainly never cared who my friends were or how I spent my time.
Who's on your trail now?
A pertinent question, my dear, but one I can't answer. In fact, I've been able to sense them getting nearer this past half hour, and I must take my departure. I noticed some excellent wards on the house, and I must congratulate you. Who laid them?
Belenos, an elf. He's at the club called Hooligans in Monroe.
Belenos.
Mr. Catalyades looked thoughtful.
He's my fifth cousin on my mother's side, I think. By the way, on no account let the riffraff gathered at Hooligans know you have a Cluviel door, because they'll kill you for it.
What do you think I ought to do with it? I asked curiously. He was standing and straightening the coat of his summer-weight tan suit. Though it was hot outside and he was heavy, he hadn't been sweating when I let him in. And where is Diantha? His niece was as different from Mr. Catalyades as you could imagine, and I was kind of fond of her.
She's far away and safe, he said tersely. And as for the Cluviel door, I can't advise you. I've already done enough to you, it seems.
Just like that, he was out the back door. I caught a glimpse of his heavy body moving at incredible speed across the backyard, and then he was simply lost from sight. Well, that had been plenty amazing, and now I was out of ham. What an enlightening conversation, in some ways. Now I knew more about my own background. I knew that my telepathy was a sort of pre-pregnancy baby shower gift from Desmond Catalyades to his friend Fintan the Fairy and my grandmother. That was a stunning revelation in and of itself. After I'd finished thinking about that, or at least after I'd pondered it as much as I could bear to, I thought about Catalyades' reference to the riffraff at Hooligans. He had a low opinion of the gathering of exiles. I wondered more than ever what the Fae were doing in Monroe, what they were plotting and planning. It couldn't be anything good. And I thought of Sandra Pelt, still out there somewhere and determined to see me die. When my head was exhausted, I let my hands take over. I put the leftover food away, transferring it from the pretty serving pieces to Ziploc bags. I washed the epergne in a couple of cut glass bowls. I glanced out the window as I rinsed them, which was how I came to observe two gray streaks crossing the yard at great speed. I could not identify what I'd seen, and I almost called animal control. But then I realized the creatures were pursuing the half-demon lawyer, and at the speed they were moving, they must already be far away. Besides, it wouldn't be wise to try to lure anything that could move like that into a cage in the back of a pickup truck. I hoped Mr. Catalyades had his running shoes on. I hadn't checked. Just when I got everything cleaned up and had changed into my cutoffs and a brown tank top, Sam called. There were no bar sounds in the background, no chink of ice in glasses, no jukebox, no babble of conversation. He must be in his trailer. But it was Saturday, late in the afternoon, when Merlot's would be getting busy. Maybe he had a date with Janilyn?
Sookie,
he said, and his voice sounded funny. My stomach instantly tied up in a knot.
Can you run into town? Come by the trailer? Someone dropped off a package for you at the bar.
Who? I asked. I was looking at the living room mirror as I talked to Sam, and I saw that I looked tense and frightened.
I didn't know him, Sam said, but it's sure a nice box with a big bow. Maybe you have a secret admirer.
Sam emphasized those words, but not in an obvious way.
I think I know who that might be,
I said, putting a smile into my voice.
Sure, Sam, I'll come.
Oh, wait, could you bring it out here? I'm still cleaning up from the party. Out here would be a lot quieter.
Let me check,
Sam said. There was a silence while he covered the receiver with his hand. I could hear a little muffled conversation, nothing specific.
That'll be great, he said, sounding like it would be anything but. We'll be out in a few minutes.
Super, I said, genuinely pleased. That gave me a bit of time to plan a welcome. See you then. After I hung up, I stood for a second, organizing my thoughts, before I sped to the front closet to retrieve my shotgun. I checked it out to make sure it was ready. Hoping I'd gain an element of surprise, I decided to hide in the woods. I laced up some running shoes and was out the back door, glad I'd put on a dark-colored tank. It wasn't Sam's truck that came up the driveway. It was Janilyn's little car. Janilyn was driving, Sam was in the front seat passenger, and someone else was in the rear seat. Janilyn got out first and looked around. She could smell me, knew I was nearby. She could probably smell the gun, too. She smiled, and it was an awful smile. She was hoping I would shoot the person who'd forced them to come out here, shoot her dead. Of course, the person holding a gun on them, the person in the back seat, was Sandra Pelt. Sandra got out with a rifle in her hand and pointed it at the car, standing a careful distance away. Then Sam emerged. He was mad as hell. I could tell by the set of his shoulders. Sandra looked older, thinner, and crazier than she had only days before. She dyed her hair black, and her fingernails matched. If she'd been anyone else, I'd have pitied her. Parents dead, sister dead, mental troubles. But my pity stopped when someone held a rifle on people I cared about.
Come out, Suki! Sandra rang out. Come out! I got you now, you piece of shit!
Sam moved unobtrusively to Sandra's right, trying to turn to face her. Janilyn, too, began moving around the car. Sandra, afraid she was losing control of the situation, began to scream at them.
Stay still! Don't move, or I'll shoot the hell out of you, you bitch! You don't want to see his head shot off, do you, your little doggy lover boy?
Janilyn shook her head. She was wearing shorts, too, and a Hair of the Dog t-shirt. Her hands had flour on them. She and Sam had been cooking. I could let this escalate, or I could take action. I was too far away, but I had to risk it. Without responding to Sandra at all, I stepped out of the woods and fired. The roar of the Benelli from an unexpected direction took everyone by surprise. I saw red blotches appear on Sandra's left arm and cheek, and she staggered for a moment in shock. But that wouldn't stop a Pelt. No, it wouldn't. Sandra swung up her rifle and aimed at me. Sam leaped for her, but Janilyn got there first. Janilyn caught hold of the rifle, wrenched it from Sandra's hands, and flung it away. And then the battle was on. I'd never seen two people fight each other as hard, and given my recent experiences, that was saying something. I couldn't find a way to shoot Sandra again, not with Janilyn struggling with her hand to hand. The two women were much the same size, short and sinewy, but Janilyn was born to battle, while Sandra was more used to quick brawls. Sam and I both circled them as they punched and bit and pulled hair and did everything to each other they could possibly do. Real damage was inflicted on both sides, and after a few seconds, Janilyn's side was stained red, and the flow from Sandra's shotgun wounds had accelerated. Sam reached into the struggling duo. It was like putting your hand in a fan to grasp Sandra's hair and yank, and she screamed like a banshee and spared a fist to punch Sam in the face. He kept his grip on her hair, though I thought she'd broken his nose. I felt obliged to do my share. After all, this was my fault, so I waited my turn. It was oddly like waiting to jump into the turning rope when I was on the playground in elementary school. When I saw my moment, I surged into the fight zone and gripped the first thing that came to my hands, Sandra's upper left arm.
Her momentum seized. She couldn't deliver the punch she was aiming to throw at Janilyn's face. Instead, Janilyn cocked one of her own hard little fists and knocked the consciousness right out of Sandra Pelt. Suddenly, I was holding the shoulder of a woman who'd gone completely limp. I let go, and she fell to the ground. Her head sagged oddly. Janilyn had broken her neck. I didn't know if Sandra was dead or alive.
Fuck,
Janilyn said pleasantly.
Fuck, fuck, fuckity fuck.
Amen,
Sam said. I burst into tears. Janilyn looked disgusted.
I know, I said despairingly. But I saw a lot of people get killed last night, and this is just one person too many. I'm sorry, y'all.
I think Sam would have hugged me if Janilyn hadn't been right there. I know he thought about it. That was the important thing.
She isn't completely gone, Janilyn said after a moment's concentration on the inert Sandra, and before Sam or I could say or do one thing, she knelt by Sandra, clenched her fists, and brought them down on Sandra's skull.
And that was that.
Sam looked across the corpse at me. I didn't know what to say or do. I'm sure my face reflected that helplessness.
Well, said Janilyn brightly, dusting her hands together with the air of one who's finally completed an unpleasant job. What shall we do with the body?
Maybe I should install a crematorium in my backyard.
Should we call the sheriff?
I asked, since I felt obliged to at least suggest it. Sam looked troubled.
More bad news for the bar, he said. I'm sorry to think about that, but I have to.
She took you all hostage, I said.
We say.
I got Sam's point. Janilyn said, I don't think anyone saw us leaving the bar with her. She was sitting low in the back seat.
Her car's still at my place,
Sam said.
I know somewhere she'll never be found, I heard myself saying, to my own complete surprise.
Where would that be? Janilyn asked. She looked up at me, and I could tell that we were never going to be best friends or paint each other's nails. Aw.
We'll throw her in the portal, I said.
What?
Sam was still staring down at the body, looking sick.
We'll throw her in the fairy portal.
Janilyn gaped at me.
There are fairies here?
Not at the moment. It's hard to explain, but I've got a portal in my woods.
You're quite the...
She couldn't seem to think how to end the sentence.
Quite the surprise,
she said finally.
That's what everyone says.
Since Janilyn was still bleeding, I stooped over to get Sandra's feet. Sam got her shoulders. He seemed to have gotten over the worst of the shock. He was breathing through his mouth, since his broken nose was clogged.
Where are we headed?
He said.
Okay, it's about a quarter mile that way.
I jerked my head in the right direction since my hands were occupied. So off we went, slowly and awkwardly. The blood had quit dripping, and she was light, and it went as well as carrying a body through the woods can go. I said,
I think instead of calling this the Stackhouse place, I'll just call it the Body Farm.
Like that place in Tennessee?
Janilyn said to my surprise.
Right.
Patricia Cornwell wrote a book called that, didn't she?
Sam said, and I almost smiled. This was a very civilized discussion to be having under the circumstances. Maybe I was still a little numb from the night before, or maybe I was continuing my process of hardening up to survive the world around me, but I found I simply didn't care much about Sandra. The Pelts had had a personal vendetta against me for no very good reason for a long time, and now it was over. I finally understood something about the mayhem of the night before. It wasn't the individual deaths I found so appalling, but the level of violence, the sheer horror of seeing so much dealt out and received. Just as I found Janilyn's execution of Sandra the most disturbing thing about today's encounter. Unless I was mistaken, Sam did too.
We reached the small open space in the trees. I was glad to see the little distortion in the air that betrayed the portal into Fairy. I pointed silently, as if the Fae could hear me, and for all I knew they could. After a second or two, Janelin and Sam spotted what I was trying to show them. They eyed it curiously, and Janelin went so far as to stick her finger in it. Her finger vanished from sight, and with a yelp, she pulled her hand back. She was definitely relieved to see that the finger was still attached. "Count of three," I said, and Sam nodded. He moved from the end of Sandra's body to the side, and as smoothly as if we had practiced it, we fed the corpse into the magical hole. It wouldn't have worked if she hadn't been so small. Then we waited. The corpse didn't get spat back out. No one leaped out with a sword to demand our lives for desecrating the land of the Fae. Instead, we heard a snarling and a yapping, and we all stood frozen, our eyes wide and our arms tense, waiting for something to issue from the portal, something that we had to fight. But nothing came out. The noises continued, and they were graphic enough, rending and tearing, more snarling, and then, after some sounds so disturbing I won't even try to describe them, there was silence. I figured there wasn't any Sandra left. We trudged back through the woods to the car. Its doors were standing open, and the first thing Sam did was shut them to stop the dinging. There were splotches of blood on the ground. I unrolled the garden hose and turned it on. Sam watered down the bloody spots and gave Janelin's car a nice rinse while he was at it. In a gut-wrenching moment, another gut-wrenching moment, Janelin set Sam's broken nose straight, and though he yelled and tears sprang to his eyes, I knew that the nose would heal well. Sandra's rifle was more of a problem than the body had been. I was not going to use the portal as a garbage disposal, and that was what throwing the rifle in after the body felt like. After some argument, Janelin and Sam decided they'd throw it into the woods on their way back to Sam's trailer, and I guess that was what they did. I was left in my house alone after a truly amazing and horrible 2 days. Horribly amazing? Amazingly horrible? Both. I sat in my kitchen, a book open on the table before me. The sun was still lighting up the yard, but the shadows were growing long. I thought of the Cluviel door, which I hadn't had a chance to use in the encounter in the backyard. Should I carry it around with me every minute of the day? I wondered if the gray things after Mr. Cataliades had caught up with him yet, and I wondered if I'd feel sad if they did. I wondered if the vampires had gotten Fantasia cleaned up by opening time, and I wondered if I would call the bar to find out. There'd be humans there to answer the phone, Mustafa Khan, maybe his buddy Warren. I wondered if Eric had talked to Felipe yet about the disappearance of the Regent of Louisiana. I wondered if Eric had written to the Queen of Oklahoma. Maybe the phone would ring when darkness fell. Maybe it wouldn't. I couldn't decide which I wanted. What I did want to do was something completely normal. I walked barefoot into the living room with a big icy glass of tea. Time to watch some of my recorded episodes of Jeopardy. Dangerous Creatures for 200, anyone?
The End. You've been listening to Dead Reckoning by Charlaine Harris, narrated by Johanna Parker. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.